Sea Air Space, August 2nd through 4th. This in-person event features keynotes from sea service leaders, the latest in naval technology, and an all-new hiring event, Transition Connection. Visit seaairspace.org to register.
Welcome to What Are You Reading? A podcast dedicated to leadership development through a commitment to reading.
This is your host, Ryder Ashcraft. Today, I am joined by Dr. Nancy Sherman. Dr. Sherman is a university professor and professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, where she has taught since 1989. She has affiliate appointments with the Georgetown Law Center on National Security and the Law and Kennedy Institute of Ethics. From 1997 to 1999, she served as the inaugural holder of the Distinguished Chair in Ethics at the United States Naval Academy, helping to design and teach the brigade-wide military ethics course and lay the groundwork for the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership. She is an expert in ethics, the history of moral philosophy, moral psychology, military ethics, and emotions. Dr. Sherman holds a bachelor's from Bryn Mawr College, a master's in literature from the University of Edinburgh, and a PhD from Harvard University. Ma'am, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
First question for you. What are you currently reading?
I just finished, so it feels like it's current, Phil Klee's Missionaries, about Colombia and the FARC and paramilitary and guerrillas and the American forces that end up in Colombia, and also a journalist. So it's a great intrigue novel with enormous amount of research laid down as its foundation, which is Phil Klee's specialty. Former Marine who wrote, of course, Redeployment and was the, I think, National Book Award winner.
Awesome. So you were previously the Distinguished Chair in Ethics at the U.S. Naval Academy. Can you discuss with us your experience and why you undertook the task of creating a brigade-wide ethics program?
Well, I was brought into the academy in the mid-90s. There was this enormous cheating compromise, namely 133 midshipmen seem to have been involved in an electrical engineering cheating incident. And it brought national attention to the academy. And there was a brainstorming session. What should we do? How do we proceed? So I was involved in that brainstorming session with the commandant and the superintendent. And we finally came up with the idea that there would be a summer course for the students. Some of them were on the verge. These were what we would call sophomores, but you're youngsters. And so they could be separated from the universe, from the academy shortly thereafter. And some might be facing criminal charges. So there was a whole different kind of collection of students involved. And there was also a superintendent at the time who might've been favoring, and it does seem he did, his football players. And he himself was a former football player. So Admiral Larson was brought out of retirement, a four-star, and he came back to become the superintendent. And I was brought in that summer to what was called morally remediate. Now, that's a term I don't typically use, but the idea was we wanted an intense course on cheating, lying, and how it might be important for the fleet in general. And then there was also a component that had to do with writing, journaling, counseling, as well as work in the community in Annapolis and the greater area. So that one thing leads to another, and that led to a full-blown ethics course, NE203, for the whole brigade that would happen in the youngster year, a full year of it. And it was mind-changing for me, I have to say, because my teaching assistants were folks that had just come back from the first Gulf War. They were flying over the Basra Road. Some were submariners. Others were on ships. And some were actually Vietnam-era. A number were Vietnam-era retired Marine colonels. And we all worked up a course sort of together. They were my teaching assistants. And I think what I discovered were issues of, oh, how Kant understands cheating and lying and prohibitions on it, how we think about collateral effects through a philosophical lens, really made sense of issues for those who had been in war and in combat, who were struggling with how to understand some of the costs of war and the ethical dimension. So I think it was mind-boggling for me, and it ended up being, I think, an important part of the Naval Academy, and it remains a course there. And I also helped found the Stockdale Center for Ethics and Leadership that is currently an important part of the outreach of the Naval Academy. So the Naval Academy isn't just doing ethics internally, but to the greater military community.
I want to key in on a point that you just brought up, that you, who are a civilian academic, was brought to the Naval Academy, and most of the people you worked with were active duty, recently returned from conflict, or maybe just recently retired from the military. Can you talk about the importance of having both of those perspectives when designing a course such as ethics that will influence so many future officers?
Yeah, I was brought in as a civilian. There were other civilians certainly at the academy, but I was brought in at a high level. You know, I was sort of brought in as the inaugural distinguished chair. So I had direct access to the commandant and to the and to the soup. And that was welcomed. I mean, it might not have been welcomed by the Navy at large, and I did get some unpleasant mail at the time. But the idea of having a wider angle of someone who had taught for many, many years, Yale and Georgetown, standard ethics courses, and bringing that perspective in that wasn't just about bottom line, let's figure out how to fix the problem, what's the algorithm, you know, wasn't an engineering model, was really welcomed. And I became very, very close colleagues with many who were struggling with heart issues. One of my Marine colonels, Dr. Rausch, he spoke often about issues of how to deal with, in Vietnam, about guerrillas who by day seemed to be civilians, but by night weren't, and how to attack those areas where they were arming up, or how to get rid of a brothel that his men were using. And he needed a lens, and he didn't have a chance until this course actually to read Kant on, not specifically on this issue, but work up case studies that applied utilitarianism or Kant. I mean, one issue that came up a lot is your guys on the bridge in a submarine, and you're coming under attack, and you know that you might lose that guy if you go under. But, you know, I've been told ship before shipmate. And what do I do? And what will happen afterwards? And if I choose to save the submarine at the cost of this individual, not intending to kill him, but knowing that you will, what will be the moral residue of that? What will be the regret? And is it the same as actively killing him? And so, these were hard issues. It brought many tears to the classroom. But I think the MIDS really understood that seeing these issues through a lens, and maybe with some the greater leisure that a civilian has to play around with these ideas, was very important. So we ended up working up cases, curating cases that brought to bear both the applied military experience, but the larger framework. And we came up with, I edited a textbook that we used, and I'm still in touch with many of the individuals. But I think part of it is the Academy was smart about it, in that they made me, they gave me the title. I didn't have, the epaulets, but it was as good as if I did in a certain way. So I could command the status that was needed. And that's very unfamiliar to me. I don't particularly work I do work at Georgetown. That's the church is about as hierarchical as it comes. And I told Admiral Larson, next to the church in the Navy is about as hierarchical as you'll get me. And he laughed, but it worked. So I think it was an amazing relationship. And I think of those years as amongst my best.
That's fantastic. I can say from experience at the Naval Academy that ethics was definitely one of the more valuable courses that I took during my time there.
I'm glad to hear that.
So shifting gears a little bit, you have a new book coming out. It's called Stoic Wisdom, Ancient Lessons for Modern Resilience. Can you share with us the premise of your research and how that may be applicable to leaders in the military?
Certainly. So when I was at the Naval Academy, I found in teaching NE203 that the specific set of readings that they really took to, like a duck takes to water, were those on Stoicism, and in particular Epictetus. And part of it is that the Navy comes by it naturally with Admiral Stockdale, Jim Stockdale, having turned to Epictetus in 1965, and then for 7.5 years after, as he was shot down over Vietnam, over North Vietnam. I'm leaving the world of technology, I'm entering the world of Epictetus. And I knew that was an important element in many people's view of Stoicism, getting it through Stockdale. But what I didn't really understand was how important it was. You know, there's Stoic with a little s, which means suck it up and truck on. And that's the mantra, you might say, at any of the academies or in boot camp. But the deeper message sometimes didn't get through, and that is, how are we connected to each other? We're global citizens, which is a Stoic theme. What are the supports necessary for grit? Do you really have to say no to everything outside your control? How do you build control and know what is outside your control? Issues to do with where's the virtue part? It's not just about self-strength and self-mastery. It's about building the common good. So the first book I wrote was Stoic Warriors, which really flowed out of my time at the Naval Academy. And I, during that time, interviewed Jim Stockdale several times. I had given various lectures in his honor, and I went to Coronado in his last years and interviewed him and Sybil Stockdale. And that was really eye-opening because he had memorized almost all of Epictetus, and it just came out of his mouth, sort of with his James Cagney-like accent. And there he was with his leg jutting out at 90 degrees because he had been pummeled upon land when he landed in North Vietnam and tortured in leg irons for 2.5 years. So I knew that source, but I also thought there was a bigger story to tell. So Stoic Warriors comes out, and then, you know, there's renewed interest in Stoicism, and I've always done ancient philosophy, and so I was on various talk shows and whatnot with individuals, and the theme of grit just kept coming over. It was loud and clear, resilience as tough grit, and as someone who reads widely in the Stoics, this wasn't the whole story. So I ended up writing Stoic Wisdom, Ancient Lessons for Modern Resilience, where I make as the center point of the book the social supports necessary for sustaining resilience. And certainly it's there in cadres, it's there in squads, it's part of being on a ship, on a carrier, nuclear carrier. And I went to the sources and I found, for example, Marcus Aurelius, who, you know, General Mattis says he always carries the meditations, Marcus Aurelius's meditations, in a rucksack during battle when he's in combat. Marcus Aurelius begins by saying, if you cut me off from others, it's as if you're a leg or arm cut off from your trunk. And he's writing this at night during the Germanic campaigns along the Danube in roughly the first, second century of the Common Era. He's seeing the battlefield and he's seeing what our troops see. Severed limbs strewn on a battlefield due to intimate killing. And he's saying, if you don't turn to each other for support, you are not whole, just as if a body isn't whole when it's strewn on a battlefield as severed limbs. And he gives lots of examples and talks about all those who've inspired him, from the grammarian who isn't carping about his bad language to his art tutor, to his mother and grandfather, and so on. And that sort of set the picture for me in turning to texts that tell a fuller story, and the story I know that's critical for the military. And that is, you don't do it alone. There's no way you do this, go into war alone. You are part of a cadre. Sometimes they support, sometimes they undercut you, sometimes you have to go up the chain in order to be able to bring sense and wisdom down the chain or across. But that's how it works. And Seneca became very important in my work, because Seneca is not, well, he's an orator and he's rhetorical and he's muddy, he's dirty, because he works in Nero's court and he is Nero's speechwriter. So he's in the muddied water of politics, but he's always aspiring. And he writes letters to others. It's an art form, but he's teaching and he's mentoring and he's saying how critical it is to get the letters back and for him to write and to see the mentoring process. And he writes plays, and Hercules Rages is one where Hercules is blinded by a jealous stepmother, Juno, and he comes back from the underworld after doing all his labors. And then he kills his family because he's got some dissociative break and he wants to kill himself. He is suicidally enraged. And it's his father and closest friend that says, use your Herculean courage to stay your anger or to show self-mercy. And I think that's critical in the military. Awful, awful things happen. You do things blinded by bad intelligence, by commands that aren't quite right, by winds that blow the wrong way, cloud cover, if you're flying. And we know there's been an epidemic of suicide in the past decade or two. And you need friends to be able to learn what self-compassion is, and to be able to turn to them for asking yourself, would you judge them as harshly as you judge yourself? Switching that perspective, which is often this perspective of therapy, is critical. And that, you know, so I'm bringing in also moral injury, how to ameliorate the toughness and the harshness that sometimes people take away from Stoicism, with another side of Stoicism, which is actually the support and compassion that come from the closest of friends and buddies who can help you build your own.
Can you expand a little bit on what moral injury is?
Sure. So moral injury is moral anguish, or in its more severe form, moral trauma. And it's the sense of a shattered moral identity. And it's often referred to in the military community, although it needn't be, survivors of sexual assault, those who see horrible trauma in their communities, civilian communities might suffer it. And the idea is that you feel like you've lost your moral compass. And it could be because you did something as a perpetrator, real or apparent wrongdoing. In the case of maybe a parent, you survive and your buddy doesn't, and you think it's because you gave yourself permission to be at this spot and he gave himself permission to be at that spot, and that was the spot where there was a mine, and he gets blown up and you don't, but you take on the responsibility. It can be overly grand at times. You could be the victim of moral transgression. A commander gives you an order that he knows will put you at risk and put your troops at risk undue risk, disproportionate risk, or gives you an order that you know to be or you think is not discriminate killing, but ends up being. Or you can be a close-up witness as a civilian, as a journalist, as a photographer in combat in these military examples. And so you suffer this terrible moral anguish expressed in guilt, shame, resentment, festering anger, a sense of betrayal. And it's very linked to post-traumatic stress, but post-traumatic stress in the 1980s, post-Vietnam, was a diagnosis or disorder or a psychological condition that had to do with fear. Fear, over-conditioning your fear response to life threat. In war, it's extremely, it's critical, it saves your life, but it's hard to turn off once it's turned on. So if post-traumatic stress has fear as its primary emotion, moral injury has anger, guilt, shame, betrayal, suicidal rage as its primary symptom. But the way people deal with it is very similar to post-traumatic stress. Self-medication, isolation, and destructive or risky behavior.
So I think that a lot of people who have been in positions like as a junior officer, where they're in combat, they're leading divisions, they're operating billion-dollar platforms, there's a lot of stress associated with their jobs and a lot of work that has to be done every single day. And I think a lot of people are really encouraged to just push past any issues that come up, anything that may inhibit them from doing their job, oftentimes at the expense of their mental health. So what is the balance for leaders in the military when understanding what their body is capable of, but also what the mission requires to be done? And is there a place for stoicism to come up with a solution for this?
It's a great question, the million-dollar question. How are you a high performer making all the sacrifices required to get the mission done and all the balancing act of not just dealing with, multi-million-dollar platforms and expensive weaponry, but also if you're in population-centric warfare, protecting civilians, if the rules of engagement suggest that you take on the burden, you, the troops, take on the burden and not incur killing and suffering on the civilian population, then the stress is enormous. So a few things about Stoicism. I think the Stoics and that passage I suggested from Marcus about being connected give you a way to think about the resources you have in each other. And so it may be that op tempo requires you to push it aside, but pushing it aside has limits and you can't hold on to a warrior mentality all the time. It just, psychologically, Freud knew this. This is old story. You can't put the cork on and expect that it won't, emotions and the frustration won't bubble up in some behavior or other, displacement behavior, it's called. And so I think just as we've learned that you had to have soon thereafter battle side mourning and permissible grief, a big lesson we took away from failures in Vietnam, funerals were delayed. Grieving was delayed because action was, because everything had to be op tempo and people suffered terribly. The idea of collective grieving soon after an incident, debriefing with psychologists, all that's important. The Stoic element in that is this, again, the idea of the social supports for resilience. We know from all of the best, social psychology, that the way Robert Putnam used an old book, Bowling Alone, put it was that we invest in social capital and social capital is critical. And I can't think of any other organization that I know of besides, you know, other than the military that invests in social capital. I mean, I've recently been reading a World War I poet, David Jones, Welsh London Fusilier, in parentheses is the poem, a T.S. Eliot era poet, not read enough. And he's in the Battle of the Somme. And what's grit in the Battle of the Somme when you're walking through trenches and then an open area to no man's land? It's the sound of each other, hearing the click, being in sync, mirroring each other's movements, the support from that muscle bonding that comes almost in your body. Marcus Aurelius talks about that kind of almost tissue connectivity. And so I think that's a sense of the glue, the connective tissue that you need to be able to resist some of the over imposition of your own responsibility in war. It comes home to roost, and there needs to be more debriefing that brings people together and also allows people to lift some of the self-blame. Another sort of method that's there in the treatment of moral injury these days from the VA, from the leading researchers, is would you blame others as harshly as you blame yourself, taking on the perspective of another? And I think that, again, is what it means to have social capital.
From a moral perspective, is there anything that young leaders can do to prepare themselves for future challenges they may face?
So one of the things I think is really interesting and very much applies to the military is the Stoic idea that there are things that are out there and then there's how we interpret them. And so one of the ways in which you gain greater self-mastery is by, as Epictetus says, say no to the things out there. And part of that means that impressions come in from outside and we filter them. I mean, we know that we are inveterate interpreters. And many these days use that idea to think about fear. Is it really that frightening out there? Or is it your overlay on it? Well, I think one of the really important ideas in Stoicism is that we do see with bias. We know that, implicit and explicit. And the Stoics sort of ask you to put a space between the cacophony of the world as it pushes in on you and what your lens is through which you see it. I think that's critical, that space. Needed even more these days as social media amplifies one particular point of view that you may not have really given full thought about its credence or its basis in fact, but you only think that it's got the support of your friends or your fellow followers on in a Twitter fan base or something like that. And I think the Stoics give you that sense of self-governance, autonomy, self-rule hegemony is the word we use, but that's a Greek word for being in charge of yourself and putting space between what comes in from outside and your overlay on it. And that's a kind of epistemological point, pretty basic, but they're one of the early set of philosophers who actually have all the apparatus for how that works. So they say, should you, here's a sort of a basic example. You find yourself in battle, Seneca says, and the noises and sounds make your knees knock, you tremble. Now he says that's just a sort of, we would say, an autonomic response. It's real fast, you can't do much about it. But at some point you can kind of look at your knees and say, ah, there they are. I'm losing my grip. And you can not assent to the impression that there's something really frightening out there. Well, that works also and works in the classroom for thinking about bias, for thinking about the quick impressions of police officers on the street, or how you're viewing an impending threat. I mean, there's got to be a balance there between quick responsiveness that will save your life, flight, fight, and studied kind of slow building of the intelligence, which is what police officers and those in civilian populations who are fighting need to do. So I think there's tools in Stoicism unexplored for being able to think a little bit about the interpretive lenses we wear. And in this, in some cases, correcting profiling, correcting biases and the like, to be explored, I think. And a different angle than many of those who work on Stoicism think about. Stoicism for many is about, it's self-help, it's self-development, it's about me and about my next new journey. If I don't want to go Eastern, I'll go Western. So give up on Zen and let's go with Marcus Aurelius. But it's not about me. And if any organization knows it's not about me, it's the military. And so I think thinking about this enlarged sense of self and the way in which we can actually train our eyes and ears and quick responses to be, to understand better, to use reason better as we interpret, that's a pretty Stoic lesson.
Thank you. It sounds like Stoicism could be very useful, not just in the military, but also as we navigate through challenges that we find in the civilian world, not just officers, but civilian members who may be supporting the military or not have no connection to the military at all. It's very interesting insight. Ma'am, do you have any other words of wisdom or encouragement for the DoD Reads audience?
Thank you, writer. Yeah, I would say read Seneca. I often, when I talk to the to military audiences recently at West Point and Annapolis, I've said, don't just read Epictetus, read some Seneca, because he's a great man of letters. And he is in the muddy waters struggling. And so something like On Anger is amazing to read. So don't think of Stoicism with a little s, think of it as with a big S. And when you turn to Stoic texts, think about the Stoics as amongst the earliest cosmopolitans. The universe that they work in isn't Aristotle's polis, but it's the cosmos. And that universe is big. That's the world in which we live, and that we're somehow all connected. And as Seneca ended his treatise on anger, let us cultivate humanity. The humanity in which we're all somehow connected and we figure out how to live peaceably together.
Thank you, ma'am, so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Ryder.
Thanks for listening to this episode of What Are You Reading? A podcast produced through partnership with DoD Reads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate, subscribe, and share it. Leave us a comment with your answer to the question, what are you reading? Also, visit dodreads.com for free books, book reviews, interviews with your favorite authors, and many more free professional development resources. See you next week.
Be at the place where maritime leadership and naval technology converge. Register for Navy League's Sea Air Space at seaairspace.org, held August 2nd through 4th in National Harbor.